Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. I'm George Taylor here with you for podcast number 45. And today we're actually going to talk about three different audiobooks, two that will be released in March and one which is already on the market. Book number one. Production has already begun on the very first of the Sherlock Holmes novels by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It's entitled A Study in Scarlet. In this book, we find out how Holmes and Dr. Watson came to be teamed together and came to live at 221B Baker Street. This book was originally written in 1886 and takes its title from a line in the book spoken by Holmes. "There's a scarlet thread of murder running through the colorless skein of life, and our duty is to unravel it and isolate it and expose every inch of it." This book features a murder with no apparent motive. There is no robbery. The deceased is lying in a vacant house. And the word Rache, German for revenge, is scrawled in blood on the wall. Yet the dead man shows no signs of bleeding. It's up to Holmes to unravel this mystery that will take us all the way from the streets of London to the mountains of Utah. Yes, I said Utah. Come March, you can join me as Holmes unravels that mystery, too. Book number two. I've just contracted to record the first novel by authors Glenn Edison and Brent Hurst. They've penned a young adult novel entitled The Destined. Although most of humanity is unaware of it, the world always has a way of protecting itself from the forces of darkness. The essences of fire, wind, water, electricity, earth, and spirit are willing to fight against the evil, although they must enter human host to do so. These people, called the Destined, arise roughly every 700 years to fight against oppression, and now the powers have chosen six hosts to protect the world. A world under attack from evil, intent on conquering all the world for its own devices. The question is, can the Destined, five teenagers and one teacher, come together to fight and defeat this power? While this is characterized as a young adult novel, you older adults will also enjoy the characters and the twists and turns in the plot. So check this book out as well. Both A Study in Scarlet and The Destined should be released sometime early in March. You'll find more information on my website. It's narrationbygeorge.com. Click on Coming Attractions. Now, let's turn to a book which is already available, our third book for today's podcast. Seasons of Change is one of those reads that's hard to put down or hard to stop listening to. Author Michael Gardner sets us outside Chattanooga, Tennessee, at a time when the economy of the United States has totally collapsed thanks to a trade embargo. All of the territory east of the Mississippi River has fallen into the hands of ruthless men who are trying to begin their own country. This new country is to be run by slave labor, people taken from the streets and from their homes to live in labor camps and work agricultural fields whose crops are to be exchanged for drugs. Our main protagonist, Michael, is hiding in the North Georgia woods, just trying to stay low. Only he is found.
"Are you going to eat all that fish, mister?"
Michael looked up from his skillet and across the campfire. A young girl was leaning against a small tree. He guessed she was about 7 years old. Her shoulder-length brown hair set off a pair of beautiful, piercing green eyes. He could tell she was hungry, but she kept her distance until she tested the waters. She was thin, but not skinny, and appeared to be well kept at her blue jeans and little girl blouse.
Michael looked down at the fish he was frying and gently said, "Oh, I guess there might be a little extra." Michael knew there was more than enough. He liked cold fish, so he had prepared enough for now, and he planned to finish it off later, before bed. Molly had been sleeping beside the fire, but now came up on all fours. She began a low growl, and the hair began rising on her back as the bushes behind the little girl began to move. The little girl took a step away from the tree. She looked in the direction of the movement. She said, "Uh-oh, busted." A young couple came through the bushes. The man appeared to be in his late 20s, a woman of about the same age followed. Judging by his haircut and his muscular build, Michael guessed he had not been out of the military for very long. The military had purged their ranks a little over a year ago, and it was a good guess that he was a victim of the purge. The woman had fairly short brown hair and was clutching the young man's shirt. She didn't seem to be afraid. It was more like she was using him for cover as she moved toward the little girl. The man nodded at Michael and said, "I'm sorry, sir. We didn't see her leave. She must have smelled the food." The woman walked up behind the girl and took her firmly by the shoulders. The man continued forward until he had placed himself between the girl and the dog. Michael was impressed. Molly was a really big dog, and few people had dared to walk in front of her for any reason, especially now when her hackles were up. It certainly took guts to stand there, just to be sure things didn't get out of hand. He gave Molly a hand signal. She looked at him, and then back at the strangers before obeying Michael. She sat down, and the tension in her shoulders relaxed a little. Looking at the young family, he realized they were not carrying any provisions. He asked, "Did you decide to go traveling with no food or gear?" Michael looked down and turned one of the fishes in the hot grease.
"Wow, mister, that is a really great dog," the girl interrupted.
"We had food," the young man said almost defensively, ignoring the girl's comment. He paused as his gaze fell to the ground. "We got jumped going through East Ridge, just north of here, and they demanded everything that we had. We had to drop everything and run."
This is not the only family running from slavery. Many of them stumble into Michael's camp, and slowly a growing encampment of refugees forms. Word of the camp spreads into the city and to the thugs who are seeking to enslave the general population.
Now, in the conference room, Tony stood at the head of the table. His bodyguard had stopped just inside the door. After he looked around the room and was satisfied that there was nothing threatening, the big man moved over to a door at the back of the room. This was the door to Tony's private quarters, and now that Tony was in residence, no one would be allowed in there without an invitation. Tony liked to have his meetings close to where he lived. There was less chance of being ambushed if you stayed in your fortress and then had others come to you when you called.
"Isn't life wonderful?" Tony beamed.
"Wonderful?" A heavy-set man halfway down the left spoke up. "Maybe for you after 2 weeks in the tropics, but for the rest of us, business is lousy. Nobody has any money, and even if they did, there's nothing to spend it on." Fat Carl, as he was called behind his back, had been with Tony the shortest amount of time, and outside of Tony's earshot, he made no secret of his dislike for Tony. Tony smiled and said, "Come on, Carl, don't hold back. Tell us how you really feel." The rest of the table broke out in laughter, which made Fat Carl turn red in the face. Tony sat down on the front of his seat and leaned forward on his arms. The bodyguard had moved to a sidebar and made a drink, which he now set on the table in front of Tony. Tony looked down at the drink. He picked it up, looked to his left, and said, "What about you, Bradford? Do you think life is wonderful?" Bradford McKinnon had been Tony's lawyer ever since Tony had come to Chattanooga. He had used his skill on several occasions to get people that worked for Tony out of jail and advised Tony constantly on how to position himself so that he would not be taken to jail in the first place. Lately, Bradford had begun to worry.
Life was no longer the same because the police were no longer a threat, and none of his men needed defending. Bradford had been worried about his irrelevance with Tony. He was a gray-haired old man now, and it was hard to reinvent yourself these days.
"Sure," he said. "A wonderful day."
Then Bradford made an exaggerated smile for precisely 2 seconds before returning to his same studied expression. Tony and several of the table chuckled at the joke. "You see, what Bradford knows is that we have a plan," Carl mumbled just loud enough to be heard. "It better be a good one, because I'm real tired of the current one." Tony paused again, still smiling, and just looked at the heavy-set man as he sat back into his chair. He touched the tips of his fingers together and said, "Some of my contacts in Colombia have placed me in touch with the authorities in Venezuela. I just spent 2 weeks with them negotiating a contract." His expression never changed. "They are willing to break the embargo, at least a little bit, and use our drug conduits to ship us supplies." Tony started counting on his fingers. "Guns, ammunition, spare parts, fuel, and anything else we need." Carl interrupted. "We have no way to pay for all that. Oh, we have plenty of greenbacks, but they're not going to want them. Nobody does as long as the embargo is on, not to mention that the Chinese are not going to let that stuff through the blockade. They don't care if we bring drugs in, but they will throw a fit if they find out we are bringing in anything we can use." Tony stood up and picked up his drink and took a couple of steps toward a painting on the wall. He pretended to study the painting as the men at the table watched him. "No," he spoke again slowly, "no, they don't want cash. As you say, they can't spend the dollars." "So what do they want? Fairy dust?" Carl grinned and looked around to see who was smiling at his joke. No one was smiling. But Carl was feeling too good to realize he was going too far. He smelled weakness in Tony, and he planned to take advantage of that. "No, that never came up," Tony turned back to the table and said. "They want grain." Carl chuckled as he tried to get those around the table to join him.
"Grain! Where are we going to get grain? Besides, we're in the drug business. I don't farm."
He had stopped grinning and looked seriously at Tony. The challenge in his stare was obvious to everyone. Tony now spoke in his regular, forceful voice. His smile was gone, and he was clearly upset.
"We were in the drug business. For a while, when there was nothing left to buy in the store, we could sell all the dope we could get. But now, even that is drying up. Nobody is making money, and that means there's no more cash to spend. Now we have a deal to trade grain for whatever we need. So, yes, we are now farmers. We grow stuff we can trade to South America."
Bradford leaned forward.
"They want grain because they can convert it into world currency. Corn is corn, and there's no way to tell where it came from."
Several at the table began to nod their head like the light just went on, and they began to understand. Tony continued,
"We grow it, or more precisely, we will have it grown. In fact, we have already started. I sent word back after the first day and started things in the right direction. General Wallace has taken most of the militia and is pushing north. He is tasked with capturing and holding farmland all the way to Knoxville."
Tony pointed at a man in uniform sitting across from Bradford.
"Captain Russell is here to rebuild the militia with new recruits and to stay in control here in Chattanooga. For some time now, he has been rounding up a labor force with any not suitable for his militia."
Captain Russell nodded at those around the table. Carl again spoke just loud enough for the table to hear him.
"I ain't no farmer."
Tony heard it, but ignored it.
"The rest of you will stop selling dope. Bring your addicts to a labor center. What we need, what we don't have enough of, is people to work the fields. We are on the lookout for farm equipment, but we need spare parts just to get them in the field. So we will use the tried-and-true method, slave labor. We will need the drugs to pacify our workforce, so stop selling it. We have set up labor centers all over the city, and they have been pretending to have good-paying jobs for all that want them. In reality, they have become our primary source of farm labor."
Tony walked back to the table and sat down. "You will protect and support these employment agencies. If people have jobs, leave them where they are. But if they are not productive where they are, load them up and take them to the nearest labor camp. The general is building the first one as we speak, and when he is done, he will let Captain Russell know where it is. He will provide escort for the buses for the people the rest of you will supply. So far, we have been keeping them on the individual farms, but we've had far too many escapes." Tony finished his drink and set his glass aside. "Be efficient, ask questions, and identify areas where most of the people are unemployed and pick them up all at once. Better yet, find where people are holed up in little sanctuaries and take them, gets rid of the rebels, and at the same time provides labor. We have no fuel to waste in our buses, so keep that in mind." Tony looked at those around the table to make sure everybody understood what he wanted.
So that sets up the conflict which occupies this book. Will the thugs in Chattanooga find the camp and enslave its population? Or can Michael keep the camp safe? This book really focuses on the theme of personal freedom, not only the freedom we enjoy now in choosing how and where we live and make our living, but the freedom to believe as we wish to believe. There is an ongoing discussion in this book focusing on religious freedom and our right to believe and practice as we wish, not to mention that Michael becomes a kind of Moses.
With the food problem on its way to being solved, Michael decided he needed some time alone to think. He whistled for Molly, went to his tent, picked up his Bible, and headed for a secluded spot he had found close to the camp. As the road above the camp came around and down the hill, it crossed a bridge over Peavine Creek. High water coming under the bridge had washed out a small alcove in the bank, and the sides made a natural bench. Molly liked it because the moist dirt floor of the alcove was cool and a good place to take a nap on a hot day. It had been dry lately, so the bench was not as cool as it usually was, but it had other benefits. The formation of the walls was a natural buffer to sound, so no matter how much noise the camp was making, it would remain quiet. The bench made it possible to forget for a little while that the camp was too noisy. He worried that they could be detected at any time. He found himself constantly getting onto campers and their kids for being too noisy lately. As he approached his hideaway, he made a mental note to talk to the others again about quieting the camp. They needed to know that they must not be noticed by passing patrols. Michael sat on the bench and tried to let go of all his thoughts of the camp. He let his Bible fall open and absently flipped the pages, reading the summary line at the top of each page. He had flipped a dozen or so pages in Exodus when it hit him. Jethro's counsel to Moses. He turned back to the beginning of the chapter and began to read. "Molly," Michael said softly as he continued to read. Molly raised her head to look at him, and he continued, "Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought the family to see Moses in his camp. What I wouldn't give for such a visit. What do you think, girl? Would you like the whole family to walk into camp and ask how we're doing? In the Bible, they all went to Moses' camp and spent the whole day hugging and kissing. Well, Moses had it a lot worse than we do, so we can't begrudge him a little happiness, can we?" Michael was sure that he saw Molly roll her eyes at him. He grinned at the thought that Molly would think he was crazy. Michael read on in silence for a little while, then said, "Listen to this, girl. Jethro chewed Moses out for trying to do everything himself. He told him that not only would the people suffer, but he would wear away." Wear away, that's an interesting way to put it. "I think I had about 5 pounds worn away today." He looked at Molly, who cocked her head as if she did not understand. He was wearing himself out, and he would not be any use to anyone when he was all used up. "Come on, girl, keep up," Molly snorted and lay back down to signify she was through with this conversation. Michael ignored her response and asked his dog anyway, "Is this written to us or what? Don't you see, girl? Our camp is coming apart at the seams. There are just too many people coming, and sooner or later we will lose control if we don't get our act together. We need a system.
and I'm remembering Moses' system. Moses broke the people up into small groups. He called it rulers of 10, rulers of 50, rulers of 100, and so on. It's the same as in accounting, only we call it duplication of success. You develop a small unit that functions efficiently with a small profit margin. Then instead of adding people to the unit, you duplicate it, and with each unit copied, you duplicate the profit. Doing that way, you can grow as large as you want, because each unit takes care of itself and does not look outside the unit for instructions. One guy couldn't micromanage the work of thousands, but control the pattern and communicate with the leadership of each unit, and you, one guy, could control the camp in every way necessary for their survival. Molly girl, I love it when a plan comes together. Thank you, Jethro. I needed that. He leaned back and rubbed his chin while he considered what he had read. Rulers of tens, rulers of fifties, rulers of hundreds, and please, not rulers of thousands. He sat forward and said, "Don't you see, girl, that if I break everyone up and assign them to a unit, then I can talk to the leader of the unit and they can pass on what needs to be done to those in their unit? We could call the groups of 10 families, and we could combine the 5 to 10 families a clan, and then we could divide the clans up into tribes when needed. Then if I have the heads of families elect a representative for their clan, I can talk to a lot of people just by talking to one elected leader. If I bring all the leaders together in a council, the whole camp is represented by a handful of people, and the information will flow downhill. We can do this, Molly." Michael got up and started pacing as he worked out the details in his mind. Molly waited patiently until Michael set off and then followed close behind. When he got back to the camp, he felt as though he had walked right into a whirlwind. There were new people in the camp, a lot of new people. He spent the rest of the day in crisis management, just trying to get everybody through the day. The author, Michael Gardner, and I sat down for an interview a couple of years ago, which was broadcast on Chattanooga's public radio outlet WUTC. News director Michael Edward Miller interviewed us. Here's a piece of that interview.
And Michael W. Gardner, your novel is titled Seasons of Change, post-apocalyptic fiction set in the Chattanooga area. What is the story here?
Well, it morphed several times while I was writing it, but the original thought was I wanted to explore the idea of what it would take to move a large group of people across the United States, because anymore, we're all walled off, we got fences, you just about can't move without going down highways. And so I looked at how many people you could move through that type of an environment. I found out that my estimate was 1 million people would stretch out 26 miles down a four-lane highway. So it got to where it became interesting to see how much I could get into it. And then I created an environment that caused the United States to just come to a stop that would require a large number of people to move from the Chattanooga area headed west.
Who is the protagonist of this book?
Well, he's the CPA.
Okay.
which, you know, that right there is an interesting juxtaposition, because most people don't think of a CPA as having that kind of inclination.
Yeah, I don't think I would look to a CPA at the end of the world to save me.
Well, I think that's a misconception, because I really thought they should have made L.A. CPA instead of L.A. Law. But this is the thought behind what would motivate a person who was not really in a overt leadership position to take on a large group of people like that, and the challenges that would be involved in organizing them and keeping them together and defending them from attacks and keeping them supplied with food and shelter and that kind of stuff. So a lot of logistics built into it.
It's interesting because, like, in the April 27th storms a few years ago, we kind of saw a little bit of that. But I think we did pretty well in the face of adversity as a community coming together, helping everybody.
Well, I add a little bit to it in that I create a situation where all imports have been cut off to the U.S. So in the situation you're talking about, we had supplies to draw on. Well, what would happen if Walmart was bare? Now, that's the theory.
This is one exciting book to check out. It's an exciting listening experience. The book is called Seasons of Change. You'll find it on my website, narrationbygeorge.com/books. Click on the books icon on that page to find links to Audible and the iTunes Store. Well, that's our time for today. Hope you've enjoyed this brief look at two new books, The Destined and A Study in Scarlet, and an in-depth look at a wonderful adventure, Seasons of Change. Don't forget, you can connect with me via email by writing to george@narrationbygeorge.com or find me on Facebook. Search for Narration by George or follow me on Twitter. I'm @NarrationByGeo. Hope you'll join me next week as we continue to explore the world of audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and more on the Narration by George podcast. Remember, God has blessed you. Share that blessing with someone else.